From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Humans have been working at this skiing thing for years. I mean, thousands of years. In his book called Deep, the journalist Porter Fox says skis 8,000 years old were found in a peat bog in Russia. They were even decorated. And his book traces that history right up to, well, now, where the skiing industry brings in billions of dollars a year. But of course, skiing is changing in critical ways. The planet is getting warmer. Fox says in some mid-latitude regions, like here in Utah, there may be no consistent snowpack by 2100, which he says means that at the moment when we humans may have finally mastered skiing, it will no longer exist. Porter Fox will join us today after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Porter Fox's book is a story of skiing. It's not a memoir, but it does get personal in that Fox himself is an avid skier. The pursuit of snow has driven many of his decisions in his life. He writes that how the sensation of giving yourself over to gravity, how pushing off down a slope and feeling your body accelerate can be almost mystical. To those who master it, he writes, an epic run is a transcendent journey. But his book is also about the future of snow. All snow, of course, but especially powder, which holds a special place in his heart for obvious reasons. Because the planet is getting warmer. And snow is changing. Powder, as many of us know it, could be a distant memory in a few generations. Today in the program, Porter Fox is joining us to talk about the fascinating history and the troubling future of skiing. His book is called Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. We invite you to join us. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Porter Fox is the features editor at Powder Magazine, the editor of Nowhere Mag. It's a literary travel writing magazine. He's joining us today from the studios of KUVO in Denver. And Porter Fox, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, I want to start with powder, if we could, because it's running throughout this book is this affection you have, it seems like anyway, to powder, the type of snow we in the West have know pretty well. You want to say something about powder? How do you describe it to people who don't know it? Like what it's like to ski in powder, to be in powder as opposed to just, you know, regular snow?
That's a great question. It's kind of hard to explain to someone who hasn't experienced it. And I grew up skiing in Maine, where it was mostly man-made snow, icy snow. When I first skied powder, it was just a completely different sport. And I describe it to people as you're falling down the mountain, but you can control that fall. Mm. You're descending so rapidly, but with subtle shifts of weight, you can sort of control it, which, you know, if you think about flying, it's the same thing. You're constantly falling, but you're controlling that, kind of like as you would in a dream. If you have a lucid dream, you can control that motion.
Mm. You begin the book talking about an island in Japan, of all places, where you can find, as you say, the lightest powder on Earth. Talk about this place. It sounds kind of, I think if you're a skier, it sounds magical, I have to say.
It is magical. And I went there for the first time, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago. And I was very lucky. I've worked for Powder Magazine since 1999, and they send you all over the earth, mm-hmm. to document the skiing life and communities and ski hills and whatnot. So I'd skied a lot of powder, and I was, you know, thought I had a good handle on it. And our first night in Japan, on the northern island of Hokkaido, actually, is where we landed in Sapporo City and drove all afternoon. with the GPS speaking to us in Japanese. It was pretty exciting.
Right.
And there was so much snow on the ground when we got there. We were just like, what's going on? And then they actually had night skiing. And, you know, we're like, what the hell? Let's go give this a shot. And right. And that was the first truly, truly bottomless powder that I've ever skied. And I've skied bottomless powder with more condensed snow. You know, they determine this by the water content of the snow. And maybe average is, let's say, 9 to 12%. In Utah, you can get into some 7 to 9% super light champagne powder. And this powder was around 5% water content, which is very significant. You can really tell the difference. And you're sinking in up to your chest as you ski. And the amount that your skis float up and down as you're going down, making a turn, you're kind of coming up from a turn, you're rising a foot or two up out of this and then sinking back down. And it was at night, there were these night lights shining, and it was magical. It snowed 10 feet in the 8 days that we were there.
Wow.
And I went back a couple years ago and skied some volcanoes up in Hokkaido. It was the same thing. It snowed 10 feet in 7 days. It's the greatest spot.
This is what you say, though, in the book. You say that this is why you wrote this book, because of powder.
Absolutely. It was, you know, when the idea first came to me, and it was from two skiers in Jackson Hole that came up with this idea of what is the future of snow going to be.
Yeah.
In a warming world, and I was like, well, and what is the story of this incredible sport? And I've just had so many transcendent experiences with it that when I started reading about the fact that it might not be the same, or it might be significantly less in the future, I really wanted to be a steward for snow in the same way that the folks that protect our winters are, so that's how we got going.
You grew up, as you said, in the in East Coast snow, learned in Maine. Like, you were 2 years old. I mean, you've been doing this a long time. But I guess you also write about how when you were a kid, you would thumbtack these ski magazine posters to your bedroom wall. So you've always had this kind of affection to it. What is it that drew you to skiing? Do you think you understand?
You know, skiing is interesting because, like a lot of other sports, I do think there's a bit more passion in the ski community. But it's one of those generational sports. So my grandfather taught my mom how to ski in the backyard of their Philadelphia home. He put hay down on the steep slope, and they learned. And you know, when my mom had kids, it was just the first thing you do. It's kind of automatic. And so I couldn't walk, but I could ski when I was 2 years old. And my secret is that I absolutely hated it when I first started, apparently, until I was, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 or something like that. Then it became fun. But it is my grandfather would ski all over the world. My mom, when she was 19 years old, this was in the early 60s, she hopped on a plane and was a ski bum in Austria for a year against her parents' wishes, and I sort of followed suit.
Yeah, you did. It's interesting. You talk about how you write about that kind of unspoken code that skiers tend to have, and that it's one of those things that sort of binds entire communities together. And I sort of detected this theme in the book that, because you go and visit a lot of these mountain communities that have, you know, the idea of skiing is embedded in them. It's part of who they are. That seems like this idea of skiing being a place of identity for a lot of these places seems to be something that you were thinking a lot about.
Absolutely. And mountain communities are unlike any community in the world that I've ever experienced. And interestingly, they're all very similar around the world. You know, in my 14 years at Powder, I kind of headed up the expedition part of the magazine's coverage for much of that time. So I did a lot of skiing in South America and Africa and Asia, Europe, Japan, Alaska, all over the place. And every time that our team, you know, the photographer, myself, some skiers, would get, you know, above 3,000 meters or something like that, and you start to walk into, like in India, we came up out of New Delhi and ended up at a little town called Shankri and walked for 2 days up into the hills to ski the headwaters of the holy Yamuna River. And when we were in Delhi, we were just getting hassled all the time. And on the drive up, we were getting hassled. And then all of a sudden, we were at altitude. And people recognized the gear that we had. They recognized the direction that we were walking in. And just all the doors open. They just want to help you. They help us find water, helped us with directions, talked about the snowpack a little bit. All over the world, in Bulgaria, in Peru, Bolivia, Morocco, wherever I was, as soon as you get up out of the flatlands, it's like they know you. Like suddenly you're a friend.
Oh, I'm not sure how much you've skied Alta. I'm sure you have. I think a lot of people who live in Alta, because it's a pretty small sort of mountain town, I think they think of it in that way probably. Too.
Absolutely. And that's such a one of the cradles of skiing in the U.S. and very specifically powder skiing. They've been doing this since the 19—oh, my God. My grandparents used to go there in the 1950s and stay at the Alta Lodge.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's where a lot of the early powder innovations had. Ed LaChapelle was there along with Atwater kind of advancing avalanche science. The first avalanche science sort of forecasting station in the country was there. And yeah, you go to Alta. We were just there on our book tour a couple of days ago. And the interest and the camaraderie among all of them there and us as kind of strangers walking into their house talking about the future of snow was you feel like you're talking to your family. It's pretty cool.
I want to talk about history because you write about the history of skiing. It's interesting. You say that there were some skis that had been discovered that go back, you know, 8,000 years, 6,000 B.C., in I guess in a peat bog in Russia, and they were sort of decorated. It may have been functional decoration, but they had these carved moose heads on the bottoms of them. I mean, this goes way back.
Yeah, this was back a little over 8,000 years ago, and that was really exciting to see. The peat bog, just the chemical composition of it, it can maintain artifacts a lot longer than anything else. That's why they found over 200 pairs of prehistoric skis, mostly in peat bogs around Asia and Scandinavia. And, you know, back then, it just makes sense when you think about it. They're getting these epic snowfalls in the wintertime, and those cultures needed to eat, and they needed to gather firewood. And instead of post-holing through the woods, they created a thing that was sort of a snowshoe, but it had a curved tip at the end. And over the years, that snowshoe got longer and skinnier, and the tip got curved higher. And and then they realized that, hey, I can get a couple extra steps by just sliding as I move forward. And then when you get to a hill, you can actually run down it. And they one of the speculations on the moose head carved in the bottom side of the tip of one of the oldest pairs of skis ever found is that it was a symbol for speed. And that's very relevant to the history of skiing because what these hunters and gatherers would use skis for in prehistoric times was essentially to go down a hill faster than a moose or an elk or a reindeer could go, and they'd have a spear in their hand, and that's how they would hunt. And the more they refined that, the more, the faster they went, and all the way through till we'll get to this in a bit. But in the Sierra in the 1850s, these downhill racers out there racing on longboards were going up to 80 miles an hour, which is faster than a human being had ever gone and lived to tell about it.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing evolution.
Well, so it kind of evolves from being something practical, useful. You know, we use this to hunt. We use this to get through the snow. When does it become a sport?
You know, it's really hard to say. If you were, you know, a prehistoric Asian hunter going 20 miles an hour down a hill, it's probably a sport at that point.
True.
Because you know it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So maybe when people started doing it recreationally, you know, then you're looking at Scandinavia and the great history in Norway. when they started to really, it probably became more of a recreational sport when folks started to learn how to turn. The telemark turn that was created there, and then the ensuing history of Nordic jumping and competition, that was all at the late 1800s, and it migrated to Europe in the early 1900s, and shortly thereafter, it just absolutely exploded across the Alps and simultaneously in the U.S.
You mentioned California. That surprised me. I didn't realize they were skiing in California in the late 1800s. And you write about these 12-foot-long boards. They had these custom side cuts. They even had a kind of a ski wax that they would put on these things. And they were, as you said, they were going incredibly fast.
Yeah, this was. I love this part of the story. And it was just a flash in the pan because, after the gold rush in the Sierras calmed down, the rest of the U.S. kind of was pretty far back in ski evolution. So there was a sudden modernization and then a bit of a quiet time. But it was Snowshoe Thompson, who actually came from the Telemark region in Norway, who started using skis out in the Sierra to deliver the mail in the wintertime. And the articles about how he could do, I think his run was between Genoa, Nevada, and Placerville, California. And this was an 8-day winter mail run back in the day, and he was doing it in 3.5 days.
Wow.
Which, if you think of FedEx today, they're like, hey, we can deliver your letter in an hour to California. It was big news, and from that, a lot of people up high in those mining towns started using skis to get around, and it was just a matter of probably months before they started betting on skiing.
Right.
That's really what pushed skiing there. And yeah, they had these quarter-mile downhill courses on 12-foot-long hickory skis, and the folks placing the bets would actually bet more on the people that were making, they called it dope. It was a ski wax applied to the bottom of the ski to make it go faster. And these sort of armchair chemists would make this wax out of buttermilk, furniture polish, whale oil, floor wax. It was all secret. And of course, there were duels fought over it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But back then, it was the 1850s, 1860s, the purse was about $2,000. So that was equal to $2,000 today. So it was a big deal back then. They were putting gold nuggets down on the best downhill racer.
And of course, you write about how we get into the kind of modern history of skiing. The first chairlift comes in Sun Valley, I think it's 1936, and then of course the war comes, and then after that these ski towns you write about, how they developed in towns in the Rockies that had these mining operations. Park City, obviously one of those. But then we get to the ski bum area, which you talk about how this was a really important movement for skiing, because in some ways modern skiing really begins as this, as you say, it's the pastime for the leisure class. But then when the ski bums come along, it's like skiing was accessible to everyone. These were working class folks. These were people who, they'd lived for skiing, really.
Exactly. And it had been, since the very beginning, it had been a sport for the leisure class. And it continues largely to be today.
True.
Except today, there is a huge population of middle class and skiers that, they work all day, they work all week, and they go skiing on the weekends. A lot of the reason that happened was that this Western migration of skiing in the East, there's a lot of cities around the ski resorts. It's, Sugar Bush was Mascara Mountain, where movie stars and politicians would go and hobnob. Of course, there's Stowe and a lot of the other places where wealthy folks from the city would go in the wintertime. But out west, it was there was a lot more land. The resorts were bigger. The mountains were taller. There was suddenly quite a bit of risk associated with skiing that the leisure class didn't necessarily want to engage in. And there you started seeing the first ski bums in the 1950s and 60s. Just moving out to live in the mountains and learn how to ski powder and bang nails during the day and ski in the afternoons. Mm. It was pretty cool.
Talk about what happened in the 1980s. Cause you say there was that sort of the great arc in this story flattens out for a bit. And then I guess snowboarding kicks in. And then shape skis and, you know, big fat skis comes into play, which has a huge effect, which kind of brings us to, I guess, in some ways, where we are now, which is it's pretty dangerous in some ways. I mean, it's really fast. And you write about how people are dying on the slopes because it can be so fast.
Yeah, it was a great renaissance in skiing that started in the mid 80s, but mm-hmm. really took off in the mid 90s. And you know, in the 80s, there was a lot of distractions to folks who typically had done what they were calling life sports back then, things like skiing and hiking, climbing. All of a sudden, there was television, video games, computers, the internet, just a lot of distraction. And a large number of, I think, almost over 200-300 resorts in the Northeast closed in the next 15 years, just for many reasons, but a lot of it was lack of interest. And then came along this this shaped ski revolution that went through many iterations before it got to where ski design is today. And it just makes skiing, if anybody, you know, most people by now have switched over. But when I first switched over, it just makes skiing so easy. Mm. You lay that edge over on the side and you're suddenly making a turn. Mm. Fat skis, you're now floating in powder instead of muscling through your turns. You can really just angle and weight your ski and you turn. Now it's gone into rocker and yeah. progressive side cut and all of these things. But what that did, when you have a fat ski where you're floating higher in the snowpack, you're going a lot faster. Mm. When you have more control over your edges and more confidence, you are now skiing a lot faster. In the park and pipe, they're jumping farther and higher. And the associated risk spiked as well. And in the backcountry, your equipment was so much lighter, you could go farther. And that's when a lot of professional skiers, ski mountaineers at first, and then freestyle skiers and big mountain skiers started to get into fatal accidents. Mm-hmm. And it was very tragic. Working at Powder, we're sort of on the front lines of getting that news. Mm-hmm. And our managing editor, Matt Hansen, did a tremendous story on it, I believe it was 2 years ago, called Nature's Feedback, and he interviewed everyone from, you know, psychologists to skiers to anyone involved in that part of the industry, and just said, why is this happening? And it's pretty simple. You ski faster, you jump higher, your risk level goes up.
Yeah, and skiers are going deeper into the backcountry, too.
Mm. Yeah, much, much deeper. And the cool part of that is, you know, they're bagging summits that were inaccessible before. But now, I mean, you can cover so many miles on a really high-tech pair of AT skis and bindings and lightweight skins and, you know, everything down to the insulating layers that you wear and the warmth and lightness of your sleeping bag and four-season tents. I mean, it's all changed.
Look, so when we get back from a break, we're going to talk about how global climate change, of course, is changing all of this. But where do you figure we are now in the skiing industry? We haven't mastered it, I guess. Everyone constantly innovates, but we're sort of in a fairly good space right now. If it wasn't for the fact that the snow might be disappearing at some point.
I think we're in a great space, and that's kind of why that line is in the book, at the moment when we mastered the sport.
Yeah.
People are just doing these things on skis that you just never thought possible. And one of those things is 80-year-olds are getting out there and they're skiing like they're 48 years old because it's just so much easier on the new ski design. Boot skis, bindings across the board. And it's fun to see some ski areas getting more visits, to see skiing back in the popular media. There was a time in the 90s when I was a skier when skiing really wasn't that cool anymore and snowboarding was all the rage. It's terrific to see skiing jumping back into the driver's seat, and I think we're at a great spot.
Porter Fox is with us. His new book is called Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about skiing. Some of you have been around since the early days of modern skiing. You've seen it evolve from those scrappy ski bum days to where it's become this $12 billion industry. The journalist Porter Fox is our guest. He's also a skier, by the way, so his new book gets a little personal as he explores the history of skiing and the future of snow, which when you take into account global climate change could be kind of bad news for you powder skiers. We'll talk about that. Deep, the story of skiing, the future of snow is the name of the book. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Well, a big part of the book, second half of the book, you really explore this idea of what's coming in terms of global climate change. And one of the things you mention is that skiers, I guess they're like surfers in some way, but you talk about how skiers depend on planetary forces larger than themselves. So I guess in some way what you're saying is skiers ought to be thinking about this part of the equation probably almost as much as anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we rely on gravity, on snowfall, weather patterns, all kinds of things like that to exercise this sport. It's not like a soccer field or a basketball stadium. Another element is that skiers are living in the snow. They are the ones who are seeing this visible change that associated with global warming more than anybody else. It's literally in their backyard, and even more so up on the mountains that they are skiing at resorts or adventuring into the backcountry, what have you. Besides the folks that are living very close to sea level, they're also seeing it. We're just another population, and as a result, what this book and Protect Our Winters and Advocates for Snow are trying to do is get skiers to come together, strengthen numbers, get them on the same page, and use our collective weight to try to tell people what exactly is going to happen in the next century if we don't start mitigating climate change right away.
You talked about how everywhere you go, there you find these stories of disappearing snow. Whether people believe in global climate change or not, you hear these stories from all kinds of people that snow is disappearing.
Absolutely. I drove 1,000 miles through the Rockies, the Cascades, down into the Northern Rockies, and over in the Alps, another 1,000 miles through all the great ski hills there. And, across the boards, I found some people that believe that humans were affecting the climate of the planet and others who didn't. But everybody had a story about how snowpack was down in their region, how winter was starting later and ending earlier, and how it just simply wasn't as cold as it used to be.
I want to ask about one of the people you talked to, and you talked to a number of these sort of climate scientists. What's interesting, I have to say, is you mentioned, I think Richard Armstrong is one of them, a lot of these climatologists, people who study this, they also happen to be skiers. Did they take up skiing to sort of to understand better this facet?
Yeah, I think it was the opposite. I think they were skiers and became interested in snow, not necessarily became interested in climate change. They became interested in snow. I mean, snow is this fascinating thing. It's a mineral. It only occurs in these very specific meteorological situations. You know, when I was in Bulgaria skiing, the snow was pink because the crystals were forming around grains of Saharan sand suspended in the clouds.
Wow.
And it's fascinating. And a lot of the folks like Robert Steiger, Christoph Marti, those European folks, Doug Chabot up in Montana, and Richard, they were skiers first and started studying snow. And in the study of snow, started to get into climatology and realize that that a lot of the snow on the planet was living on borrowed time.
Mm. You mentioned the 2011-2012 season had been one of the warmest. Many of the country's ski resorts opened late, many closed early. 9 of the 10 warmest years on record, of course, occurred since 2000. There's this University of Colorado study that I think a lot of people have been paying attention to, which mentions that temperatures, for example, could climb more than 10 degrees in Park City by 2100, which essentially means what? Talk a little bit about the implications of all of that.
You know, we've been going around the West all month talking about snow, climate change, what might happen. Of course, everyone wants to know regionally what's going to happen right here. So these forecasts are based on what they call a high emissions scenario, a status quo, and a low emissions scenario. So that Colorado study was based on a higher emissions scenario where temperatures very easily could climb to 10 degrees in Park City. And in that situation, there would be zero consistent snowpack on the mountain, i.e. the mountain closes. Mm-hmm. That same scenario, Aspen would be relegated, skiing there relegated to the top quarter of the mountain. What we're trying to do is avoid that. We're trying to get people together, force our collective weight in Washington, make national policy shift in how we create and consume energy, and try to keep the mountains very similar to how they are today. One of the greatest thing that I found while researching this book was that it just doesn't have to be this way. And with all of the incurable things on the planet, like cancer, like Alzheimer's, it's absolutely shocking that the one thing that we know how to fix and poses the greatest threat to humanity, including our mountains and snowpack, we're not taking it on like we should.
What do you mean by that? We'll get to this question of geoengineering, which is one thing, but what else do you mean when you say there is something we can do about it? Because I think there's this sense of hopelessness about all of that, that we're sort of at the point of no return.
You know, there is a lot of things that every skier can do. In fact, Protect Our Winters has right on their homepage the POW Pledge 7, and it's 7 things that you can do. Things like get political, get to know who your congresspeople are and let them know how you feel. Things like just speaking up. If you see a Facebook blast or an email blast that is talking about disappearing snow, send it on to your friends. Talk to businesses. Talk to the business that you work in and say, well, what are we doing to lower our carbon footprint? Right in your house, you can just start off by changing all of the light bulbs to low energy CFLs or something like that. There's this great statistic about New York City, where I live, where if everybody in the city changed their bulbs out to CFLs, you could run the MTA subway for a year on the energy savings. These are very simple things. They say the first 15 to 30% of energy conservation, which is a big part of this, is very easy to do. Bordering on not doing it is kind of being lazy, painting the rooftops white on apartment buildings in major cities, things like that. The next 30% changes people's lifestyle, which is more of a fight. But right off the bat, walk to the store instead of driving your car, carpool, insulate your windows. People probably know what those steps are. And it just really means digging in and getting started.
One of the things you make really clear in the book is that this is not global warming is not a tragedy because people won't have powder to ski anymore. it's a tragedy, you point out, because of its effects on the Earth's water cycle and the climate system. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. I mean, because what happens if there are no more snowpack or glaciers beyond the fact that, you know, we can't ski epic powder? I mean, there's less natural water stores, you know, dry conditions. I mean, that's really what you're getting at, of course.
Absolutely. And that was another revelation I had while researching the book, is that snow is a vital element of the climate system on Earth that actually keeps Earth relatively cool and temperate. It's also a very important part of the water cycle. Without snowmelt, snow and ice are natural water storage. And without that, you don't get the runoff in the spring and summer that waters farmers' fields, that maintains river habitat. Snow and ice represent, they're the sole fresh water supply for more than a billion people around the world. If you just think of the Ganges Basin, the most populated corridor on the planet, all of that water comes out of the Himalayas. And when you look at the ramifications of a lower snowpack, everything from forest fires to mountain pine beetle infestations to the farming scenario, it's amazing. It's a chain reaction that gets kicked off. And that's, you know, a whole separate argument is the reflectivity of snow. Mm-hmm. Sends a lot of solar radiation right back up into space, or up into the sky anyway. And the more snow melts, the less reflectivity you have on Earth. That dark soil absorbs more heat. Planet warms faster, more snow melts. It's a bit of a cyclical thing. The frozen permafrost in Arctic Canada that holds millions of tons of methane. If that melts and that is released into the sky, methane being more than 20 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas, you're going to look at a global warming situation many times anything that humans created.
You mentioned it's a problem here, of course, in North America. But you see, the problem is even worse in the European Alps. And this is the part of the book you talk about what would happen in those high peaks of Europe. I want to talk about some of the people that you introduce us to. Alfonso Pascual, I think, let's start there, who sounds like a kind of fascinating Spaniard who grew up in Paris, lives this kind of extraordinary life of adventure. You want to talk about Alfonso?
He was terrific, and it was just chance that we got hooked up together. He was my guide to ski the Vallée Blanche one day, and the Vallée Blanche being the famous off-piste run off the Aiguille de Midi tram above the Chamonix Valley. And I wrote about this a bit. As we started off, he said, "Oh, you like boats too?" And I've been a sailor for much of my life. And he said, "Yeah, I tried sailing. I got a boat a few years ago from a lake in Geneva. And then I just sailed it around the world." Yeah, it was a 28-foot boat or something like that. I don't even think it had a full keel. He wasn't crazy, but he was adventurous. He had traversed the entire Alps on skis just to see if he could do it. So at any rate, we're skiing down, and I didn't have to ask Alfonso questions. He just started telling me the changes that he saw.
Right.
He can't ski the same routes that he could 20 years ago. He can't climb the same routes. The crevasses have moved. A lot of the historic spot to stop and eat lunch on the Vallée Blanche isn't safe anymore because the crevasses are growing. And when we got to the foot of that glacier, which is the Mer de Glace Glacier, is essentially the bottom runout of the Vallée Blanche, one of the most famous glaciers in the world, being the first place that folks went as kind of a mountain travel scenario. They went there to see this beautiful glacier, this wonder of the earth in the 1700s. Mm-hmm. And then there were two English guys, and they went back to the UK and explained it to what they had seen. And all of a sudden, there was mountain tourism had started. And that was its start. And there we were on the Mer de Glace Glacier, and it's receded a mile and a half since the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And Alfonso goes every summer to install iron rings in a ladder that you take to climb up off the glacier to the first climbing refuge if you were to climb Mont Blanc. And every summer he goes and he has to put a few more rungs in that ladder, reaching down to where the surface of the glacier is now. And the glacier has thinned so much in the last, even in the last 25 years since he's been in Chamonix. He's lowered that by almost 200 feet. So it's kind of shocking to see that, and as he described, the lack of snow and ice in the valley, melting glaciers, lack of snowfall, early spring, late start to winter. His face was pretty blanched as he was explaining that, because he hadn't read too much about why it was happening. He was just seeing the results.
I like this part where you write about how Mary Shelley describes the High Alps, and this would be in 1816 in her book Frankenstein, and you say it's the greatest description of what is at stake in the high peaks of Europe. I wanted to have you either read this or talk a little bit about this section, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. This was fascinating to discover, and actually my grad school teacher back in New York pointed it out. He said, I know the Mer de Glace. He said, that's in Frankenstein, and that's it was in 1816 when Mary and Percy Shelley traveled to see this wonder of the world. Mary Shelley was 18 years old, and she had been writing Frankenstein for some time. And so they climbed up. They had quite an expedition. Percy slipped and fell, knocked himself out on a boulder. It was raining most of the time. They finally made a last push and got up to Montanvert, which is the destination where you kind of walk out onto the glacier. And she wrote this passage. I'll just read the passage very quickly about standing there and looking at this the sea of ice. From the side where I now stood, Montanvert was exactly opposite, at the distance of a league, and above it rose Mont Blanc in awful majesty. I remained in a recess of the rock, gazing on this wonderful and stupendous scene. The sea, or rather the vast river of ice, wound among its dependent mountains, whose aerial summits hung over its recesses. Their icy and glittering peaks shone in the sunlight over the clouds. My heart, which was before sorrowful, now swelled with something like joy. I exclaimed, "Wandering spirits, if indeed ye wander, and do not rest in your narrow beds, allow me this faint happiness, or take me as your companion away from the joys of life."
Porter Fox is with us. His book is called Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Porter Fox. We're talking about his book, Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. I wanted to ask you about, you talked about the fact that there are things that people can do, you know, to be environmentally conscious and all those kinds of things. But then there's the stuff that ski resorts are desperate to find solutions to this if all of that doesn't work out. And you point out the ski resorts have been sort of in on this geoengineering game for some time now, cloud seeding and snow making, and people are getting really creative. Talk about this part of the story.
It makes sense that they would be looking for ways to stabilize the snowpack. And this is some of the older skiers would remember the drought in the 1970s when a lot of the ski resorts couldn't open for Christmas. Terrible snow year. And snowmaking really became popular shortly thereafter. For a ski business to work, you just have to be open for Christmas week. And you have to have a certain number of days to be open to make it worth it. So snowmaking became very popular. Now 88% of the ski areas in the country have snowmaking on them. A lot of them have 100% snowmaking. They can blow snow on every single trail on the mountain. This is something that almost by happenstance has become an adaptation technique for ski resorts to exist in a warmer world. We understand now a little bit more about how fast the world is warming and that snow line is climbing. But snowmaking was a big part of it. The issue there being that snowmaking is incredibly intensive in terms of its use of electricity and water. These are two things that are very likely to be in short supply in the coming decades, especially out west. So in terms of a long-term solution, I highly doubt that snowmaking is it. As a stopgap measure, certainly it's helped a lot of places, as has cloud seeding. Vail has been cloud seeding for over 30 years, and places like Breckenridge and I believe Arapahoe Basin and a few others are experimenting with it. There's extensive cloud seeding operations in Wyoming. In a lot of states, actually, the water district will work for try to create cloud seeding operations so that they get a more consistent water supply. That snowpack, once again, is what provides water in the spring and summer, and it's working now. It's probably not the greatest long-term solution, but good for right now.
We point out that even with climate change, of course, there are going to be places where there is natural snow on the planet for some time now. You talk about Siberia, Arctic Canada. Developers are scoping those places out.
Absolutely. They've put hundreds of billions of dollars into development. Just recently, planned development in Siberia and the winter sports infrastructure there. That's very clearly, they realize that that's one of two places that's expected to get more snow in the next century and remain cold enough to keep it, Arctic Canada being the other place, the other region up around Baffin Island and whatnot. So even though skiing might not disappear from the planet completely, when it is relegated to Siberia and Arctic Canada, it's likely not going to be the same as it is today.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I wanted to kind of come back to that because you talk about, the art of skiing. You talk about the camaraderie related to skiing. How, in the ski bomb era, which sort of revolutionized it, in at least as I see it, in terms of its class, you know, extending it to people who weren't just in the leisure classes. What happens to the art of skiing? What happens to that? What happens to these mountain communities? What happens to all of that if, you know, skiing, powder skiing, any kind of skiing, goes away?
It's going to change drastically. There's a certain momentum to climate change that even if we stopped insulating the earth with greenhouse gases today, it would still continue to warm to a certain extent. So like Daniel Scott's study on the U.S. Northeast, half of the 103 ski resorts there are likely going to have to close in the next 30 years. And what that means to the art of skiing, the practice of skiing, is more people going to fewer resorts. Means less powder, more man-made snow, more hard pack. In the U.K., they're skiing on dry slopes. They have a surface there that you can ski on, and it's 500, 600 vertical feet or so. Hugely popular there right now. I'm not sure it would be the same here because we have another option. Indoor ski slopes, they're proliferating around the world, and that's not the same skiing that I know. The skiing that I know is getting out into the fresh air and seeing these beautiful white-capped mountains and skiing powder and skiing bumps and slush and all the different sastrugi and corn and whatever you can find, and getting into the backcountry and hiking up above the tree line into these white snowscapes where you can ski for miles at a time without seeing a person. That's the skiing that I grew up with and that I would really hope to be able to pass on to my kids and grandkids, and I think any skier today would probably feel the same way.
You mentioned in the book how by the end of 2013, there finally seems to be some kind of general consensus that that there is such a thing as global warming, that people are making the planet warmer, that the effects are going to be bad. And you refer to the conservationist and writer Bill McKibben, who talks about how none of it is easy. There's no yellow brick road, he says. But you sense, it seems like you have a sense of optimism about all of this in some ways, but I'm wondering, you know, you have to sort of temper your sense of despair if you look at the particulars. I mean, how are you thinking about all of this now?
It's definitely not going to be easy. I was honestly, Doug, I was relieved that there was a path. The first 6 months of research that I did, it felt like a foregone conclusion to everyone I spoke with. You know, they're saying you're going to see 4 to 6 degrees Celsius warming on this planet in the next 100-150 years, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And anything above 2 degrees Celsius is a catastrophe. And not only skiing as we know it, but quite simply life as we know it will be substantially different. And so when I talked to Daniel Scott, and then he led me to some great sources of how people can mitigate climate change and whatnot, it was a huge relief. And even though it will be difficult to change our lives and conserve more energy move towards renewable energy, at least there is a pathway. And the skiing community, mountain community that we're trying to bring together is an incredibly energetic, very powerful, influential, and very smart population that could help a lot of the scientists that are working for a pathway forward to help make that a reality. One of those things is right off the bat closing coal-fired power plants. And this is the dirtiest energy that we're using today. And there's a lot of it in the West. There's a lot of coal coming out of the Powder River Basin in Montana and Wyoming, headed to China now. This is something that's going to affect communities, and I think we all need to come together and find the best way to do that, because it's going to benefit all of us in the end.
That's Porter Fox. He's the features editor at Powder Magazine. His new book is called Deep, The Story of Skiing and the Future of Snow. He joined us from the studios of NPR affiliate station KUVO in Denver. Porter Fox, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond also. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.